Thank you for your attention. My name is Dan Gibbons, and on behalf of the City Club of Chicago, welcome to City Club. Welcome back to City Club to so many of you. We have our, I think, a quorum of our Board of Governors here. So I'd like to acknowledge Dr. Ed Mazur, Jackie Robinson-Ivy, and Omar Dagestani. Thank you for being here and for your support, and of course the sponsors, and that's why there are so many tables up front here that I'd like to mention. Advocate Health is here. The Illinois State Treasurer's Office, of course, is here. JDL is here consulting. Loyola University of Chicago. Dr. Reed, welcome back. Always good to see you and your team. Loyola University Ramblers Brotherhood is also here. We love seeing the students in the room. Pretty soon they'll be at the board table, right? In training. The Mid-America Carpenters Regional Council. Wade and team, welcome back. Always great to have you all here. Oric, Harrington, and Sutcliffe. Where are you? That way? Thank you. People's Gas is here. Deshauna, thanks for always bringing the right folks. Of course, the Attorney General, Kwame Murrell's campaign, thank you for your support. And Northern Trust. Northern Trust, and Jackie and Frank and the crew. As you'll hear from the Attorney General in just a couple minutes, he always appreciates working with others and collaborating, and there's an incredible group of people here from the civic, the civic community, elected officials. We have a Representative Tarver is here, Representative Bob Morgan is here, Representative Kim DuBoucle is here, Commissioner Donna Miller, Council General Brian Cahalain from Ireland is here. Thank you, Council General. Mary Richardson Lowry from the city is here. Mary and Karen Freeman Wilson from the Urban League. Mayor Freeman Wilson is always a great speaker at City Club. We'll have her back. As is Ellen Elberding. Where's Ellen? Ellen from the also on the Loyola board. Ellen, it's always good to have you back, and we hope you're enjoying your semi-retirement. Kevin Willer is here also with Phil at the Loyola table. So many great people here who make this city work. Cindy Mullis from the Pritzker Trauber Foundation, Jim Francik, of course. Great group of people. So thank you all for being here. Thank you all. Elizabeth Morano, the Morano family, great supporters of City Club. All of you do your part to make this work and to make this city work. Of course, President Cullerton, who I saw the empty seat. It's because he's at the right table. President Cullerton, always good to have you back at City Club. So we have one special guest, and his team is here as well. And this man doesn't need a whole lot of an introduction. Before I do that, I'm just going to mention I'm going to sit down and have a chat with the Attorney General. And I have some prepared questions, as usual. I have some pre-submitted questions from some of you all. And then we have a microphone right here in my hand that Caleb is going to come up a little bit later. And if you do have a question out there, hopefully we have a few extra minutes, please think through those questions. There's so much to discuss. We're going to get right to it, and this man needs no introduction. We're all here to see him and hear from him. Please welcome the Attorney General of the State of Illinois, great public servant, Kwame Raoul.
Do it. A lot of people, man.
Welcome back.
You didn't tell me you were going to have this many people. I wouldn't have come.
These are some great people, as I mentioned.
Quick shout out. Everybody came into the neighborhood and had hopefully a safe trip to the neighborhood. I want to give a special shout out to my partner in law enforcement, Chief of Police for the Cook County Sheriff, Leo Schmitz.
Yes.
You may notice the presence of a lot of sheriff deputies in the River North and the Central Business District at large. That is an intentional presence as a result of Leo's leadership, and we've partnered a lot on organized retail crime, and the difference to the Central Business District is significant.
You can feel it certainly in this neighborhood too. Yeah, thank you, Leo, and thank you for mentioning him. I'm sorry that I didn't. I also see Rich Guidis is here, another great public servant.
Absolutely.
Who's done so much to keep our city safe. Thank you, Rich.
And one last brief thing.
Yep.
You know, you said mayor when you mentioned Karen Freeman Wilson, but once an attorney general, always attorney general.
Correct. General Karen Freeman, a woman of many titles, and former mayor, former attorney general. Thank you. It's been a year since we've done this, more than a year. It's been quite a year.
It's felt like about 5 years.
It is April Fool's Day. Is this all a joke? Where do we start? I feel like every day, I think we'll go right to, if you're okay with it, right to executive orders. There seems to be a new one every
day. Speaking of April Fool's Day.
Or Groundhog Day, I don't know. There's something new coming out of the White House every day. I can't keep track. You have to keep track. It's your job. I see that you're working with all sorts of other attorneys general. Did I say that right? Attorney generals?
Attorneys general, yeah.
And you know, some of these executive orders you may not agree with, right? Could you give us an overview of where you're focusing your attention? There are so many different orders, and they affect so many different policies that may conflict with the state of Illinois. Where to start? Where are you focusing your energies and your efforts?
Yeah, so they've been fast and furious, right? And let me first say that, you know, I recognize that President Donald Trump was elected President of the United States. That as an elected president, he has a right to seek out the policies for which upon which he campaigned, right? Which, you know, some of the executive orders are sort of consistent with that. And however, one of the things that has to happen in the system of government that is the American government experiment is that it has to be lawful. It has to be consistent with our Constitution, and it's got to be consistent with the laws that Congress has laid out. He's chosen to, with many of these executive orders, ignore both, whether it's ignoring separation of powers or the fact that the Congress has the power of the purse, ignoring plain language of the 14th Amendment with regards to birthright citizenship, which is kind of a personal one for me because my mother was a Haitian immigrant. She was not yet naturalized at the time of my birth, so I refer to myself as a birthright baby. So ignoring what's called the Administrative Procedures Act and doing things that are just plain unlawful. So the common thread of when we come in is, one, whether the executive order is unlawful. Two, whether the state has been harmed, and whether as a result of those harms, whether we can establish standing. So there are a lot of executive orders that you'll see that we have not directly filed a lawsuit, but other parties have. In some of those instances, we've weighed in by way of amicus briefs, and some we haven't. That doesn't mean that we disregard those issues, that we don't think those are important, but we come in when we have the appropriate standing and when there are harms directly to the state of Illinois.
And how about if the harm is to a private entity like a law firm? I mean, the legal community, it seems, is we have such a presence here in Chicago with different law firms.
So we also have Bully Pulpit, right? I became a lawyer to be a voice for others. My daughter's here. She's a second year somewhere. Put your hand up. She's a second year law student. And I presume she's going to law school to be a voice for others, too. Fundamentally, we have enshrined in our Constitution this right to counsel, and there's a spirit of that as well, more broadly. And it should not be inappropriately muted by intimidation from the President of the United States. I went to University of Chicago Lab School. We studied a lot of Shakespeare. I wasn't great at the study of Shakespeare, I confess, but somebody else who went to the University of Chicago Lab School was the late Justice Stevens.
Oh yeah,
and he had a sort of different opinion of first we kill all of the lawyers from Henry the Sixth. That many people interpret that to be disparaging to lawyers. He thought it a warning of the first step towards totalitarianism, and he referenced that in a opinion, I think 85, so that's why I led an effort, open letter to the legal community at large, that we should not stand by when this type of intimidation of involving not allowing lawyers from firms access to federal buildings based on who they represented. If we allow that to happen, if we sit back as any lawyer, any and every lawyer has a responsibility to use their voice in this instance and not take the approach of, well, they haven't come after my law firm, so I'm going to be silent on it. Or, worse yet, the approach of, well, if they've gone after Perkins Coie or Jenner and Block or, who else am I thinking of? There's Yellow now. Yell it out. Skadden. If we sit back and say, well, if they're deprived of clearance and they're deprived of access to court buildings, we can move in and take their business, then shame on you. I think there's a common thread. I visited Israel a few years ago, and at Yad Vashem, there is the quote of Martin Niemöller. First they came for the socialists, and I said nothing. And it ends up, then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak. So if people think they're safe by being silent or being complicit, you're wrong. And it's not just about the lawyers that attacked on lawyers. Across the board, if somebody's being attacked, and there's broad attacks across industries, if you're not a federal employee who has been laid off, or if you want a federal employee who's retained their job, everybody needs to speak out. And this is not partisan, because there are Republican farmers, Republican federal employees, there are law enforcement departments, funds trying to be frozen towards law enforcement departments. There are, farmers, again, there are people of both parties impacted by Medicaid. whether they realize it or not. Just because you have something that looks like a commercial card doesn't mean that you're not impacted. So the silence is deafening. We do it through legal action and bully pulpit. So a sign of bully pulpit is this open letter to the legal community, because that's something near or dear enough to me, where I say, okay, I should use my, while I'm busy enough with the actual legal actions that, and we're winning, right? But that doesn't mean I ignore my responsibility to speak out on other matters.
So how does this end? I mean, there's so much uncertainty. There's so many people that are that don't know if they can go to work, or that don't know if they're going to have a school, you know, education department, the immigration, every issue, we talked about the legal community. Does this all just go back to the courts? I mean, is this a drawn-out multi-year process? Where does the legal system, where's the final say? How does that work? Or we know where it's supposed to be.
So I've watched a lot of fictional movies about government, and what I've witnessed would have been too unreal to put into a fictional movie. It would be unbelievable that such such things could happen. I don't have the magic answer as to where does it end. I think something important going on today, just across our north border in Wisconsin, there's a pivotal election, and I'm hopeful that of a certain result in that election, and I hope that will send signals to elected officials of both parties to go see the wizard and get some courage and speak out. Because, again, silence allows this to keep on. Yeah, we can file lawsuits, and, again, we've been very successful in getting temporary restraining orders and some injunctions thereafter, and we've had to go back in on motions to compel. But again, we don't have standing on everything, and the president has been unapologetic and audacious about the nature of the actions he's taking, and quite frankly, as president of the United States, it's not only the actions you carry out, it's the things that you say that have impact both domestically and internationally that are quite frightening if you really listen to some of the things being said.
Are we in a constitutional crisis?
I knew you were going to ask that question. So different attorneys general have answered that question differently, and I don't engage in any such declaration, and I think it's far premature to say that. We have, as I said, we have challenged some of the actions, and we have done so successfully, restoring flow of funding to certain programs. So the evidence suggests otherwise. That doesn't mean we haven't had to go back in. And so we have to be, we can't just go in and assume that because a judge has ordered something that everybody in the federal government is going to abide by it. And so we continue to get information. And if there's enough reason to go back in, and there have been instances of such, we will go back in. And that has worked thus far.
Good. So for those who are frightened, there is hope.
I believe so. And I think Chief Justice Roberts coming out and speaking on the heels of the attack on the judiciary, this notion of going towards impeaching judges whenever they rule against you, I thought that was very important. And it forced the occasion for the president to say, I'm going to be abiding by
a good signal ahead of,
and I will just appeal. And so those things suggest otherwise. It's not to say that I don't believe people should be uncomfortable about the number of executive orders and the ones yet to come. We should all be uncomfortable about that, but just going to this place of declaring constitutional crisis and shrugging the shoulders and saying there's nothing we can do, we're doomed. I don't take that approach. I take my job. I put my hand up as every elected official has, and I swore to uphold the Constitution and the laws of our country and our state, and that's what I'm doing.
And this is all on top of your day job, right? I mean,
well, then that's a good point.
I mean, how long you've been Attorney General for?
Six years, a few months. In the last 3 months, it feels like that was 6 years by itself. But it's important to note that, you know, there's been a lot of attention on a state attorneys general over the last few months, but this work is not new for us. It's much more intense over the last 3 months, but I came in halfway through a Trump 1.0. We sued a lot, and Lisa Madigan before me was part of lawsuits prior to that, and we won 80% of the time in those. So it was taking place. We were fighting for a republic back then. Now, after seeing Project 2025 and studying that last year, we as attorneys general got together and not knowing what the results of the elections would be, we started preparing. Because the plans laid out in Project 2025, the policies that were being articulated during the campaign suggested that we needed to be ready just in case. And I traveled into a few states campaigning for Kamala Harris, but not knowing what the results of the elections would be, I couldn't wait until November to start preparing based on the wide range of plans laid out in Project 2025, Agenda 47, or just being articulated during the campaign. And one thing I can say for Donald Trump, he's trying to deliver on the things that he promised, right? You know, and we may have thought that they were he was just running his mouth, and those were just unbelievable things. But, you know, I'll give him credit for that, I guess. You know, he's trying to hold to his campaign promises. So the wonderful thing is, you know, if you serve as a chief legal officer of the state, certainly, everybody except me, of course, but certainly you have somewhat of an ego, right? And
we're gonna get to that.
And you get 23 of us in one room.
We had a few of them at City Club during the DNC. That was interesting.
Yeah.
Remember when we had that great conversation?
Well, if you notice during that conversation, you notice our collegiality.
Oh yeah.
Right? That's because we've gotten to know each other. It just didn't happen over the last 3 months, right? We've gotten to know each other over the years, and people always ask me how things are in Springfield. I actually have spent just as much time out of the state meeting with fellow attorneys general than I have down with my former colleagues in the legislature, because of our, and it's on a bipartisan basis as well, because there's a lot of subject matter that, believe it or not, we do work collaboratively with Republican attorneys general. I know them well. I know some of their family members, and we've gotten to know each other. That's what allows for an easy working relationship. I can pick up the phone and call any one of my colleagues. Our staffs have gotten to know each other well, perhaps not as well as they've gotten to know each other over the last 3 months. They're literally communicating on a daily basis. And so, we know each other.
I've heard you talk about your colleagues and then also your team as a family, which I always appreciate. It's a great thing to see public servants who are so passionate and dedicated. I see a lot of your team member. You have a great team here.
Yeah, I've got a great team. For all the law firms in the room, don't think you can come over and start poaching right now. But I've got great lawyers. I had a misconception when I first started as a lawyer. I started in the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, and I often tell people I used to bring my bag lunch and sit outside at the Daily Center and watch classmates of mine who went to big firms go to the restaurants that I couldn't afford to go to because I was making about $30,000 a year at the time. And assistant attorneys general, their starting salary was about $5,000 less than mine. So I had this misconception that if you worked at the attorney general's office, you just sucked as a lawyer, right? Because when I came into the office, the pedigree, I get feedback from federal judges, Supreme Court judges, appellate judges, as well as circuit court judges, on our attorneys that come in the courtroom, and this is not feedback that I'm soliciting. Whenever I attend a legal event, I have at least a couple of judges come up and compliment me on the quality of counsel that we have appearing before them, the level to which they are prepared. And recently I was I attended an oral argument down in Southern Illinois, held down in Carbondale at Southern Illinois University for the Supreme Court, and one of our attorneys, Garson Fisher presented an oral argument, and I saw one of the justices just yesterday, and she said to me, Garson is always very well prepared, even when he doesn't have the best of case to present. He's always
like some of my high school teachers, maybe. If they're all, I see you're hoping to add staff. You obviously have a whole lot more work going on with these last few months. So can we assume that your budget is growing significantly from the state legislature?
Curtis, I mean, I know we have Bob, Kim. I'm making my case. It's a tough time for the legislature right now.
I saw an article just this week, right, a week or so ago.
Yeah, and so we have to be, there's a lot of belt tightening that has to go on. I do believe in living within your...
And assuming next year is going to be worse, right?
Yeah, but I also believe in investing where it makes sense to invest. It's like running any business, that it's a tough time doesn't mean you don't make investments. You make investments where there's a good return. So over the 6 years that I've been Attorney General, for every dollar from the state, legislators listen carefully, for every dollar that we've received from the State General Revenue Fund, we've returned 22.5 to the State General Revenue Fund. I don't know, anybody here in the financial services business would tell you that's a pretty good return, and even in a time when you're tightening your belt, that's something you should invest in. And importantly, I don't say that. I mean, the thing that folks are focused on right now is, the federal, I like to characterize it as federal overreach litigation. Yeah, that has put a strain on a lot of our lawyers. But the other aspect of some of the acts of the federal government is, if you think about rollback, for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, at the FTC, at EPA, DOJ stepping back from DOJ and the Department of Ed stepping back from civil rights enforcement. Who's going to fill the gap? Mm-hmm. State attorneys general. These are entities that historically we have collaborated with, but there are policy decisions being made, some illegal, but some maybe legal. We know, notwithstanding the lawsuits that we may file, that there are going to be rollbacks in all of those agencies. There's going to be pulling back. We are in the midst of a consent decree with the Chicago Police Department as a result of initial investigation from the Department of Justice under Loretta Lynch's leadership. Once Jeff Sessions came in, he said, oh, that's not anything for the Department of Justice to care about. That's for local authorities to worry about. And so that's when Lisa Madigan stepped in. So we can anticipate that same type of philosophy from this administration. And so that increases necessarily our workload. So even more than the sort of federal accountability litigation that we're engaged in, is filling the gap where in the areas where we could rely on federal regulators to step in. And that includes public safety as well, because unfortunately there's pulling away from a lot of our law enforcement partners. And I've really enjoyed, and Leo can testify to this, we've really enjoyed great partnerships with the FBI, DEA, ATF. ATF has been a great partner for us in going after gun trafficking, which is such an important issue for the city of Chicago. But when you got agents being pulled away for immigration enforcement, public safety suffers as a result. When there's a suggestion of merging ATF and DEA, suggesting that you're prioritizing what's been actually successful less, and public safety will suffer as a result.
So it's been a bit of...
And then when you're threatening to freeze JAG funding for local police departments, it's defunding the police.
Interesting when you put it that way. In good time, I was going to mention a minute ago to remind everyone that we at City Club are not partisan and not biased. This President Trump spoke from this stage a number of years ago. We welcome him back, I think. So it's all good conversation, but I do like to remind people that we like to have all those conversations and hear different sides as well. This is a pretty convincing argument. Let's come back a little more to locally. You know, I joked about your day job.
Yeah.
I mean, if there's been somewhat of a distraction these last few months, or that's an understatement. What's working here? I mean, you have guns, you have drugs, you have corruption. There are things that you have plenty of team. Your team had been working on. What's working? What are some successes? I know retail theft continues to be a problem, although it seems like it's getting better. We talked about it a couple of years ago. Yeah. What have you seen that's working?
Teamwork. When I attended a Attorney General Alliance meeting of attorneys general, and I received a presentation from a loss prevention person from Home Depot on this notion of organized retail crime. And my first response was to them, oh, you mean retail theft? They said, well, yeah, retail theft is a subcomponent of it, but no, this is a little bit broader. There are sophisticated criminal rings. Yes, the end act or the initial act looks like this unsophisticated, brazen smash and grab or a whole bunch of people running into the store, but there are layers of that criminal ring that have turned to this criminal activity and using these people that we've seen certainly on North Michigan Avenue and Oak
Even
Brook
just yesterday up in the north side, I think there were, overnight, I think there were a few smash and grabs, right?
Yeah, so the important thing is to fully understand the layers of that criminal activity. If we're just looking at what's put on the evening news and the brazen acts and say, we just need to deal with those people. Those people can all be replaced. They're being put out there to do that because the proceeds of that activity, whether it was during the protest after George Floyd's murder, the proceeds of that can be easily monetized on online platforms. And so,
is this the new mafia, the new organized crime, or the new gang?
It is organized crime. It is organized crime, and there are sophisticated organizations. Some are international. I always use the example. I think it was out of Arizona, the AG's office in Arizona. It was either Arizona or New Mexico. There was a what seemed to be a ragtag group robbing from grocery stores and convenience stores and liquor stores, steaks, tequila, and wine. And they knew that there was a woman locally in charge of this group, and they thought that she was a small-time actor. And when they finally arrested her and her team, they had stolen over $1 million of steak, tequila, and wine. And what were they doing with it? They were shipping it to the cartel. Such that they'd be distributed in the villages.
Are you getting up the ladder?
Working it up, working up. Yep. Can't talk too much about it, but Cook County Sheriff's Office has had some really, really successful bust. Our office early on, We discovered as a result of an arrest at a nightclub, over $1 million of stolen items in storage facilities. There was some evidence as a result of that one arrest that we noticed, and we got search warrants and recovered all sorts of stolen items, a lot of leggings.
Did you find any of my electric scooters? I've had two of them stolen.
I don't recall those, but there was something suspicious about this guy at the nightclub having a box of leggings in his car.
I'm sure you see some very interesting things. How about the new? We have a new state's attorney locally, in Cook County. Mm-hmm. How is that? How's that going with your collaboration, or is there hopefully some collaboration there?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'm scheduled to have breakfast with her soon, and we started speaking before she even took office. One of the things I did at the outset of my tenure is I tried to enhance the collaboration with state's attorneys at large. Our office, where we weren't before, participate on their weekly calls. We've collaborated on legislative matters. I've collaborated well with Bob Berlin out of DuPage County. Leo will tell you, he always convenes us. We always have an informal dinner meeting of just different law enforcement leaders. And I think that's
tequila,
important.
Steak, and wine?
No tequila. I'll neither affirm or deny the other two things that you mentioned. But those interactions are important interactions, just for us to just socially interact. Just as I mentioned with regards to my attorneys general, both Republican and Democrat from across the country. I've even broken bread with Ken Paxton, believe it or not, out of Texas. Don't throw anything at me. But
I heard a gasp.
But I look at it as important to do because even with him, there's been occasion of collaborating on certain matters to protect consumers. And so the same exists here locally. We have a lot of alum from the Cook County State's Attorney's Office in our office. We benefited from some of the attrition that they suffered, and so we have a very strong prosecutorial bench. And what I've shared with Eileen is that we can collaborate. We often do so in smaller counties throughout the state, where if either there's a conflict or if they just don't have the capacity or the talent within their office, because we got 102 counties in the state, and some state's attorney's office have like part-time staff, right? And so Vermilion County is one county where we've handled a lot of murder cases down there. So we've got a strong bench of experienced prosecutors. We've got great investigators. So we've really enhanced the type of investigative work that we do out of the Attorney General's office, and we really embrace force multiplying. And so I did a little poaching myself. Mathalina Hudson, who's here, was my chief of staff. I originally hired her to be deputy AG of criminal. I poached her from the U.S. Attorney's Office. She helped me find somebody as our chief investigator who had retired from the FBI. And their pre-existing relationships have helped us collaborate with some of those agencies, and I'm hopeful that we're just as successful as we were with the first Trump administration, notwithstanding the politics of collaborating on law enforcement efforts together. And we've proven ourselves to be an important partner, notwithstanding the fact that we don't have a vast investigated staff, or while I say we have a strong bench of prosecutors, it's not the number that we would need. There's some attorneys general in certain states that they serve as the local prosecutor as well in all of the counties. We don't have that model here, but we're active.
You said a trigger word that City Club perks up every time you say politics. Let's talk about local politics. Change it up a little bit. Nope, we got 15 minutes. And speaking of, because I do want to get to some audience questions, so please keep those coming. But of course, we can't let you go until we start talking politics. What's going on locally? It seems like I feel like we're on the verge of a reorg, if you will, of state and local politics.
I guess. I don't know. There's been no major announcements yet. Let me say this about politics. I mean, much has been made in the environment that we're in about whether or not, I'm going to talk about the Democratic Party for one. There's been a lot of criticism of the Democratic Party, and there's been some criticism of Senator Durbin based on the continuing resolution vote. One of the things I've understood since I served as a legislator, for 14 years, is you're gonna have to take some hard votes. We would always say within our caucuses that you're gonna have to take some hard votes, and we need a few. Sometimes it's like, we need a few people to take a hard vote that perhaps the public at large might not understand or may not disagree. And sometimes the most courageous people are the people who do something that's very unpopular in the moment. I don't know how I would have voted on the continuing resolution, but I'm not going to drag anybody over the coals without a very healthy, well-informed debate about everything that they were facing in that moment. It's so easy to just read a newspaper and just cast stones at somebody with not fully appreciating. We have a representative democracy for a reason. Because you send legislators to Springfield, you send legislators to Washington to deal with information that they're receiving from lobbyists and advocates and others, and to digest all that and make an informed decision that we as individuals at the local level don't have, aren't privy to all that information that goes into that end decision making. So I'm not going to spend my time throwing stones or pointing fingers at others. You know, I was once at the University of Chicago where the students were protesting something, and I think it was the provost or somebody turned to the students and said, you know, whenever there's a crisis, you know, I always resist pointing the finger outwards unless I first point the finger inwards and ask myself, what have I done? What can I do in this moment of crisis? And so there's too much of this going on. There's certain politicians, I don't know if they're, that are lifting themselves up by pointing to what the Democratic Party or certain Democrats aren't doing. And if I might risk naming a name, while I appreciate Senator Sanders, some of his advocacy for certain issues, he's too much of a finger pointer sometimes for me. And, you know, one of the things, quite frankly, that I care a lot about is the fact that gun violence is the number one killer of children in America, and I still can't reconcile myself with the fact that he voted to give immunity to gun manufacturers that are much responsible for trafficking guns into the hands of people we know will do harm with them. So I generally resist it, pointing fingers at others without asking myself.
Pointing sort of at yourself and you see some of this, and let's pretend that there are term limits on attorney general, where would you see yourself in another position?
That was a tricky way of asking that question.
Get you all comfortable.
At least it's a better way that than... You know, that was slick, Dan. You know, the question that I hate, and I hated it when I was a state senator, and I hate it, I especially hate it as attorney general, when people, even early on during my tenure, came up to me and started asking me, what's next for you? And why I hated it, and why I still hate it, and so I'm glad you asked it in a different way, is because it underappreciates the place where I am. And so finally, you know, not the perfect circumstance for state attorneys general to be elevated, because I'd rather not have the crisis that we're in for people to appreciate what state attorneys general have long done. But I look at being a state attorney general as a destination, not a stepping stone, right? And if, you know, and I'm not going to be state attorney general for forever, right? I do believe in passing the baton. You know, I did have one colleague that served as attorney general for almost 40 years in the state of Iowa. Believe me, I won't be serving for 40 years. And I think I do believe in giving other people an opportunity. What I do want to do is I do want to build out a legacy in the Illinois Attorney General's office, and I think I've started to do so. I do certain things a little bit different than my predecessor had done, but that's not a knock on her. It was just my own imprint on the office, and I'd like to believe that some of the unique things that I've put in place will remain beyond my time of leadership. So I do believe, and this might be a cop-out answer, that the best way to prepare for any future job is to do the job that you're in effectively, not for the sake of climbing. I do believe that there are a lot of people who look at the offices they're serving in as just stepping stone offices. I don't look at mine as that. There's certain things that I certainly would not do. People have asked me about the U.S. Senate seat, and there was even presuming that Durbin decides to do something else. There was even, I think, an article that came out this past week somewhere, somebody showed me and had me listed. I thought all the media in the room, take me off those lists. I do not want to go to Washington. I want to stay here.
Your staff appreciates hearing that, too.
And this is no knock on Senator Durbin or Senator Duckworth. I truly believe what I do on a day-to-day basis has more impact on what I could do as a U.S. Senator. It might not be appreciated by the Sunday morning news shows that are so Washington's centric, but it's more than I believe. I know that the Attorney General's office just, and it's in every state, produces more than a single U.S. senator can for its constituency. So why would I leave doing something more important to doing something, I'm not saying unimportant, but less impactful?
That's interesting.
So I'll
take the answer.
I'll answer it that way.
That was good.
And I don't want to be mayor either.
Equal. So. That was what I was really getting. I am also like to provide other opportunity. And if anyone has a question, Caleb is here. I see one over there. I'm going to ask you to take this microphone, and we really only have about 5 minutes. Does someone else have a question? All right, so Caleb, if you could maybe start here at our Loyola Ramblers table.
Speaking of Loyola Ramblers, shout out to a Final Four player that I helped train in elementary school.
Oh, yeah?
He finally started squaring his feet up to the basket, but Lucas Williamson, who I helped
All
train
right.
in elementary school.
So if you don't mind, let us know your name. And
hello, I'm Elijah Niang. I'm a sophomore here at Loyola University of Chicago. I'm also an APS and associate fellow. So the question that I have for you is, you talked a lot about the executive orders that Trump has put passed in the last month. What do you think is the most harmful towards democracy?
And can I ask you to do that relatively quickly so we can at least get one or two more in? That's a great question.
And I'll give you a cop-out answer. They all are, because almost in all of them, not all, there's an element of ignoring our Constitution. Whether it's birthright citizenship, funding freeze, either the 14th Amendment, Congress having the power of the purse, separation of powers, and so on. It's, like I said, we all, as elected officers, put up our right hand and swear to uphold the Constitution. And I also said to you at the beginning that Donald Trump does have a right to pursue his policy agenda. I can't sit here and say that, he doesn't have a right to seek out government efficiency, to seek out a smaller government, but there's a way of doing it. If he wants to get rid of the Department of Education, he needs to go to Congress and have them do it. So, what's laid out in our constitutional is a foundation for the American experiment that we've abided by for the most part for 250 years. And so they're all threatening because they're ignoring the Constitution.
Caleb.
Right over here. Hello. Oh. I'm Harvin Singh, and I'm a proud City Club member. Thank you for all that you do. Given that the Republican Party, especially at the federal level, is living in fear of vengeance from the White House, how do you feel Republican judges are managing that fear, and will they stand up for the oath that they took, or are they as fearful of the vengeance from the White House?
Well, I'll set aside that one judge in Florida that was presiding over the criminal case. But what I will say is, you take birthright citizenship. It was a Reagan-appointed judge, and he was very stern in his language. And he says that it was blatantly unconstitutional, and in addition he said he did not understand how any member of the bar could come into a courtroom and dare even make an argument on behalf of the legality of the action. That's a Republican judge, and so it's also Justice Roberts that spoke out. Supreme Court justices are conservative about speaking out while things are still working their way up. But Justice Roberts spoke out publicly at a time where it was very much needed because he understood that the credibility of the judiciary was at stake. So I commend him for doing so.
I think we have one more. There we go, all the way in the back to the right.
My question is, where do you see faith communities and non-governmental organizations either having standing, or where do you feel that they should join in fighting back some of the effects of the executive orders? You mentioned earlier the Attorney General's office doesn't always have standing for certain things. What do you recommend to us as faith leaders or as community leaders? Where should we be taking up the mantle?
Well, I think ultimately, and that's a very good question, I think ultimately everything cannot be fought in the courts. And people have to care. I spoke earlier about silence. People have to understand, even though they may have not yet directly felt the harms. It's working their way. It's working its way to everybody. I attended a town hall meeting in Minnesota that my colleague Keith Ellison hosted. And there were three other AGs in addition to two of us, and we didn't come there to preach to the more than 2,000 people that were there. We came to hear testimony from people who had been harmed, and hearing from a veteran who had served two tours of duty and suffered a traumatic brain injury on each tour, and came back home and went through rehab and was able to get herself back to a point where she could be productive, and chose to go to work at Veterans Affairs helping other veterans. And she had received all positive performance reviews, and then one day came into work and had a post-it note that she was fired.
asked everybody in her direct line of reporting what this was this about. None of them knew anything about it. Hearing compelling stories like that and communicating them to people at large, you have Republican leaders telling other congressmen, don't hold town hall meetings. That's because Republicans are being hurt. People are being hurt, not by way of their labels, but all sorts of people are being hurt across the board. And there's what I would say to you is get people, and I spoke to a group of pastors at a convening that Rainbow Push hosted last week, and I said, you know, we have to get people to ignore the tool that the president is using to focus people on who they hate, whether it's focusing them on hating immigrants and trying to point the finger at immigrants as to why they may not be where they are employment-wise, or hate transgender people, having people all worried about who's in their bathroom or on the sports team, the turning of the acronym DEI into negative connotation, saying things like DEI hire. When you break out DEI, the words are diversity, equity, inclusion. What is inherently negative about any of those words? But so much of us, by way of our silence, have allowed the term DEI to be perceived as a negative term by way of our silence. And some of us have done so because, well, they figure, oh, this one doesn't affect me, so I'm not going to worry about it. Well, believe me, it's going to get around to everybody. The harm's going to get around to everybody. So I return to Martin Niemöller. First they came for the socialists. And I said nothing because I was not a socialist. Carpenters, then they came for the trade unionists. And I said nothing because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews. I said nothing because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me. And there's nobody else left to speak for me. It's going to get around to everybody. And shout out to the Carpenters. One of the things that I think we, Chris Wells, who heads up my public interest unit, has underneath him the worker protection unit. One of the things that I'm very worried about is the ever-expanding wealth gap in this country and the type of economy that we're growing into, and the misclassification, the growing misclassification of workers. And I don't think it's going to get any better under this administration. And some of us may be in jobs where it may not affect us because we have health insurance and we've got other benefits, but more and more people are being classified as independent contractors, I believe illegally so, to avoid providing for family, having people to be able to provide for themselves and their families and have the type of health insurance and workers' compensation protection. And we're being silent because we get our Amazon packages very conveniently every day. There's a bill that's being debated in Springfield right now that hopefully can come to some compromise. We got to pay attention to those things. And we can't allow the fact that we have convenience I'm not going to lie. I get product delivered directly to me, but it's at somebody's expense. And my son, is my son here? Is Jay here?
He is. Yeah.
He was a 2020 graduate. And if you remember, that was when we're in the heat of COVID, and it was a very difficult time for you to be graduating from college. And so he ended up taking a job as a manager at an Amazon facility. And he ended up leaving that job because he didn't like the way he was being told to manage the workers at that distribution facility. And I was so proud of him. Y'all give him a hand.
So I have notes on a whole host of programs that I think are going to have to come out of this conversation. So thank you for that. Attorney General Kwame Raoul, thank you for fighting for Illinois, for each one of us. There's so much more to come from you, it sounds like. There's so much to come here at City Club. Like I said, I have some notes on some future programs that I think we need to dive in deeper on, so many things that you talked about today. And we very much are dedicated to sharing this platform to share all sorts of voices. So please keep those ideas coming, keep the topics coming, and keep the incredible speakers like the Attorney General coming. We do have a few coming up tomorrow, actually. We have Tom Skilling, our favorite retired meteorologist, and Don Wobbles talking about climate change with Chancellor Miranda from UIC and strategies to alleviate poverty on April 9th. Incoming Park District Superintendent Carlos Ramirez Rosa on April 23rd, and the new arts education plan from CPS on May 7th, and plenty more to come. Thank you for always being supportive of City Club. Thank you for being here and giving us a few extra minutes today. To all of you, thank you especially to you, Attorney General Kwame Raoul. Thank you, and you're welcome back anytime.